Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Welcome to Walking in Faith. We have a legal show for you this morning. First up, we speak with Professor John Lawrence Hill from Indiana University. He's here to talk about the natural law. He's written a book called After the Natural Law. And then following that interview, we speak with Maureen Ferguson. She's a senior policy advisor for the Catholic Association. She's here to explain the recent United States Supreme Court case on the Little Sisters of the Poor, what that means for our own religious liberty, and what we can expect in the future. So let's get started with those interviews right now. Good morning. This morning we're joined by author John Lawrence Hill. He's written the book After the Natural Law. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Now, this book is a fascinating journey into the history of philosophy and theology and science. Tell us a little bit about why you wrote it.
Well, I had been an atheist myself earlier in life. And as a law professor, I had begun to realize that many of the things I was writing about and thinking about, things like freedom, liberty, human dignity, moral values, all of these things that we believe, and by we I mean most everyone today, liberal, conservative, middle of the road, that I didn't have the foundation really to believe in them. I began to see real contradictions in my own worldview, and so I began to think back more deeply about what one has to believe, and it eventually led me back to God and to the Church.
Talk a little bit about Nietzsche, first of all.
Well, Nietzsche is really one of the great philosophical forerunners of, I guess, of the postmodern era. He lived from 1844 to 1900, German philosopher. He spent the last decade of his life, he had contracted syphilis as a student, in fact, and was basically gone insane by the age of 44, and yet many of the things that he wrote in the last several years before he sort of slipped into his haze were, as I say in the book, eerily prophetic. On one hand, he was an atheist and God is dead, and we're looking forward to a wonderful period of cataclysm. When I first read this quote, it sounds almost demonic. He talks about the glee we experience that God is dead, our horizons are open, a period of promise and premonition and cataclysm and onward. And it's the strangest mingling of sort of this Promethean glee, and at the same time, it's very dark, very demonic. And in a way, he predicted. I mean, he died in 1900, but he predicted, I think, in many ways, the first half of the 20th century and beyond, and all the wars, concentration camps, the things that we faced, and they really followed from his philosophy in so many ways. And he's been profoundly influential in the 20th century. His atheism, his postmodernism, his whole way of looking at the world.
Talk a little bit about how this plays out in this continuum of history.
So the book itself traces Western philosophy, really, from the ancient. And what I found, the more I studied the Western philosophical tradition, is that we've gone in a big cycle, in that the debates that we're having today in the United States are really echoes of debates they were having in Athens around 400 BC during Plato's time. And they're the same debates. Is there objective moral truth, or is it all just sort of values that we make up? And Plato himself debated a philosopher by the name of Protagoras, who was really the first, I'd say, the first pre-modern postmodernist. I mean, Protagoras was the guy who said man is the measure of all things. He's really the first true secular humanist in philosophy and in history. And Plato is debating Protagoras, and we see their exchanges in Plato's dialogues. And so I think, yes, that there's been an arc through history, and we've sort of seen that that Plato and Aristotle are the good guys in Western philosophy. They were not Christian, they were pre-Christian, of course, but they began to see very clearly that there has to be a mind that has designed the world. And they began to lay the groundwork, I should say, for what we now call the natural law worldview. So they began to put things in place, and Thomas Aquinas is really the hero of the book. He sort of weaves together Christian theology with some of the philosophical discoveries of Plato and Aristotle and some other philosophers. So I kind of trace the whole arc of Western philosophy up to Aquinas in part one, and then part two of the book shows how modern philosophy slowly sort of deconstructs that. And even people that the American founders look to as people who helped construct our own foundations. John Locke is an important philosopher. We think of him as a natural law philosopher, but even Locke began to doubt. And so the seeds of what we're facing now are even evident in his philosophy. So the book sort of traces the rise and fall of this whole natural law worldview. And the fall has been, really commenced about 400 years ago. It started in Locke and Descartes' time, and we're really seeing the end consequences of it today.
Okay, let's go back to Aristotle and Plato. I think they're important figures in the history because they are pre-Christian, and they're in a world where the gods are the mythological figures that, many temples and many different things. But the idea of God then was that, he had total control over man, and, it was just something that the fates and all that. So, but they had the philosophical ability to reason that there was this natural law. And I guess I was a little bit confused when I read the book, the difference of what Plato believed and Aristotle believed. So if you could point that out a little bit.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because Plato and Aristotle both represent, there's a strand in Catholicism which represents Plato's strand and another that's Aristotle's strand. And if you talk to Catholic theologians, they'll talk about this. St. Augustine was really a follower, in a sense, of Plato. And Thomas Aquinas was more the follower of Aristotle. The difference is that Plato was more the idealist. And the soul and the body are completely separate, and the body kind of weighs us down. And, in order to free the soul from the bondage of the material body, we have to engage in ascetic practices and this sort of thing. So Plato's more of the hardcore.
And that would definitely appeal to St. Augustine, who at one time, dabbled in is it Manichaeism?
Yeah.
So that was a very distinct thing that they taught as well. The soul and the body were completely, which is declared a heresy, actually, by the church, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. And St. Augustine himself eventually saw the problems with Manichaeism, but it led him from his atheism, really. It was the way station between atheism and Christianity for him.
Right. Now talk about Aristotle, because you talk so beautifully about Plato. Let's hear what Aristotle said.
So Aristotle was more the naturalist, I would say. Plato is a poet and a mystic, in a sense. Aristotle was more the scientist. Just to give you a sense, he died in the 4th century B.C., 322 B.C., Alexander the Great was his student. Alexander would go on campaign and send back specimens of animal life and plants. And Aristotle was probably the greatest scientist of his age. But he was also a great philosopher. And so for Aristotle, matter and soul, he really had two principles, form and matter. But for him, they were intertwined. You couldn't separate them out. And Aristotle sort of represents, I think, the more life-loving, in a sense, the more earthy strand in Catholicism, the strand that says that good food, good wine, a good marriage, these things are important in life. The body can't just be dismissed. The bodily values are important, though they have to be properly ordered. So I think Aristotle is the patron sage of those ideas.
Yeah, that sounds extremely Catholic to me, that there is, yeah, that, you know, everything's good in moderation. It's that middle road that, you know, we don't go to the extremes of saying the body's bad or you can't have any alcohol or anything like that, which other religions have strayed into through the years. All right, so now we're going to Aquinas, wonderfully integrating with the Catholic doctrine the beauty of this philosophy and theology.
Right. Yes, yeah, so Thomas Aquinas lived from about 1226 to 1275. So he's the 13th century, and the Crusades had just been fought. And what had happened is Aristotle's great works, again, Aristotle wrote around 350 B.C., all of his work disappeared. No one knew what had became of it. They'd heard about this person, Aristotle, after Christ, for example, during the Roman times and then after the fall of the Roman Empire. But most of his works had been lost. When we fought the Crusade, when the West fought the Crusades, they rediscovered Aristotle. It turned out that, that his works had been copied and kept in a library in Syria. And so about a generation before Aquinas was born, Aristotle re-enters the Western canon and we begin to have people translating him from the Islamic sources. And so Thomas Aquinas' teacher was one of the first to begin to translate Aristotle. And when Aquinas, genius that he was, encountered these things, he said, these ideas fit beautifully in many ways. Some of them have to be tempered, but they fit beautifully with our understanding of the world and of God. Now his idea of God is different from our idea of God, but in very general ways, Aristotle thought that the soul, for example, he called it the substantial form of the body. He referred to the gist of his philosophy, again, is that the spiritual and the material elements of things are actually intermingled, and we can't just sort of distill them into two separate substances. So it's a beautiful mingling of the terrestrial and the holy or the divine. And Aquinas saw this and began to write. And Aquinas said philosophy, we can do without it, but it's a stepping stone for people. And in my own case, personally, it was very helpful to have that stepping stone because I needed to sort of understand before I could get to God, myself and my own spiritual development as an atheist when I was younger. I mean, I needed to begin to understand how there could be a soul, what this might mean. And so Aquinas rightly saw that philosophy was a light to the world. It was a way of beginning to understand some of these deeper spiritual truths.
Indeed. And a way to order your life in terms of answering questions about why you would, maybe I would say as an atheist, would pursue something that you would think would make you happy and ultimately doesn't make you happy. And so is that where the philosophy then comes in terms of why would something that apparently is supposed to give me so much joy making me so miserable?
Yes. In fact, it's funny. Plato has this quote that's, again, Plato is really the poet. He's such a beautiful writer. And he talks about all things in the world, all human beings and all things of the world are searching for the good, but they don't see it. They can't see it. We're all driven toward it. I mean, we're all moved toward our own good, but we don't really see what it is. So our paths are sort of haphazard, and we go this way and then that. And it was a beautiful, again, precursor to some of the wisdom of Christianity.
And it's such an anecdote to what we're experiencing now with transgenderism and all these ideas of confusion and, you know, we can ultimately determine who we are in terms of our minds becoming what our bodies are. It's very, very confusing right now.
That's a great point because Aristotle, what happened in modern philosophy is when they began to dismantle this worldview is, one of the mistakes modern philosophy makes comes from Descartes, the French philosopher. And Descartes is the one who began to say, I think, therefore I am, and began to sort of move back to the idea that mind is separate from body in that what we are is what we think rather than what we are physically. And so the whole transgender issue is a function of, I mean, that this notion that I am not what I am physically, I can believe I'm black even if I'm white, I can believe I'm a man even if I'm a woman. These ideas place the mind, and not even the whole mind, but just the particular thought or desire above the body itself, and make of that wish or desire sort of the ruling element in the body. And that's where Aristotle would have said, and Aquinas would have said, no, our thoughts don't make who we are. We are physical and spiritual beings, and you can't sort of distill them out. So I see in a lot of this transgender business the extreme working out of Descartes' whole philosophy.
Well, exactly. Like, I think I can fly, but if I jump off a mountain, gravity's going to take over.
Right,
my mind
right.
might want to fly, but my body is going to weigh me down to the earth.
Well, there was that woman a year ago who was the NAACP director for the state of Washington who insisted that she was black even though biologically she was white. And apparently she continues to insist she's African-American. And, again, that's another version of the same fallacy that, you know, you can look, if I just think I'm something else, I am.
A brain surgeon. Don't
yeah.
operate on anyone. Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, it seems common sense, you know, to most people could figure that out. I don't want to think that I'm something, an inanimate object. I couldn't become that even if I wanted to. I'm breathing. I mean, that seems so apparently false. But I did want to just go back because my other confusion is now William of Ockham. And he comes right after Thomas Aquinas. He's a Franciscan friar. But he really sets in motion this whole, he topples Aquinas very dramatically in terms of the history of the philosophy and theology. So talk a little bit about him, and he confuses me terribly. So talk a little bit about that.
Yes, Ockham was really, in a sense, the first modern philosopher. And you're right, he came just 50 or 75 years after Thomas Aquinas. He was famously embroiled in a controversy with the Pope during his time over apostolic poverty. So he sort of had this, he's really the father of modern secularism, for one thing. He sort of, you know, rebelled against the controversy he had with the Pope by beginning to write treatises that said, in essence, that the church ruled one sphere and princes ruled another sphere, and the church had no business telling kings and princes what to do and such. So on one level, he's the father of modern secularism, but in a philosophical way, Ockham is the one who begins to rebel against Plato and Aristotle and Aquinas, who all believed, in a sense, that when we think about the world, and sort of a strange, philosophical query, but when you think about the world, Plato said, there are different degrees of reality. Some things are literally more real than other things. You know, you think numbers, shadows, events that occurred, God, human beings, trees. Modern philosophers, and I think most modern people, tend to think that, well, either something exists or it doesn't exist. There's no middle way. And that creates all sorts of problems for modern philosophy, and it's a doctrine called nominalism. And Ockham is the father of nominalism, though he didn't quite go as far as modern nominalists in some ways. But he basically said, you know, that the only things that really exist are physical things and qualities. And the upshot of all this is that he began to sort of question the idea that some things are more real than other things. Everything is as real as everything else that exists, which means God is as real as a shadow. And so there was, it set in motion philosophically a whole sort of cascading series of consequences that unfolded over the next 400 years. But again, it's all, I think people today we're all nominalists, or most people are nominalists. We just, things either exist or they don't. But the idea that Thomas Aquinas had following Plato, that there are greater and lesser qualitative degrees of being, he would have said as a philosopher.
Now, give us an example of that. How would we understand that practically?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of an example that won't go too far afield. Let me give you an example. Once people started to think that God was no more real than human beings, I mean, he may be greater than human beings in the sense that he's more powerful and more intelligent. But once we began to think that, you know, you either exist or you don't, a human being exists or does not, God either exists or does not, it was very natural for us to begin then thinking, Aquinas' idea of God was really a profound idea. He said God is the absolute ground of all being. And he unpacked that in marvelous ways. But for modern philosophers who wanted to continue to believe in God, they had to start thinking of God as kind of a spirit in the sky again. And before you know it, we had people like Thomas Hobbes in the 1600s who said, well, only physical things exist. If God exists, he's got to be physical. He has to exist somewhere in space. And so we have this sort of progressive physicalization of everything as a result of Occam's mistake. Everything has to be physicalized. And so it makes it difficult to think about the soul. It makes it difficult to think about mathematical entities and other things that are very difficult to explain.
And yet that goes against the idea that if I just think I am. So how does Hobbes reconcile with Locke?
Well, Hobbes and Locke, Locke continued to hold on to aspects of teleology, which was teleology is the fancy philosopher's word for this idea that the world is an ordered place. But in Locke and Hobbes lived at roughly the same, they overlap. But Locke still believed in God. Hobbes, I don't think, did. He talks about God, but I think he did it more as a matter of prudence. He didn't want to be hanged for atheism. But Hobbes begins to talk in a much more materialistic way. Hobbes is really the modern philosopher. He would be at home today.
Yeah, I see that. And don't you see this internal tension between these ideas of materialists? If God exists, we've got to see him, and yet I can create in my mind who I am. I mean, there's an internal illogic there.
I see where you're going with that. Yeah, I think there is. I think it's one of the contradictions of modern thought. Right. Something either exists or it doesn't. You can't just make it up.
And if I can't see it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that is a real contradiction of one of the many contradictions of the modern worldview.
Yeah, and I was taught, you know, Aquinas said that man is created good. His ultimate purpose in being is to go to the highest good, which is union with God, and that God equips us and gives us all that we need to get there. But we need to realize that this is the path. Whereas Occam is saying God's just some guy who is able to change at a whim anything he wants because he's all-powerful. And we can't, he could say tomorrow to do evil would be what his desire was because he's incapable of, he's not locked into anything. He's just God, so he can choose whatever he wants, which I find is inherently, you're either good or not. Good can't exist with evil. It's impossible. But he would say is that we just simply have to choose whether we're going to obey God or not. That we have the power to do that. He took the idea of the design of man ordered toward good, towards the decision of whether or not I want to believe or not believe, and whether or not I think God is capricious and whimsical, or I'm better at choosing my fate. So is that right, too? Is there that tension going through there?
You're making lots of important connections there. Yeah, absolutely. What Occam really does is to begin to deconstruct the idea that we are all ordered to the good, that there are built-in. I mean, Occam is really, and Locke really follows Occam in so many ways, two English thinkers, separated by a couple of centuries, but they both begin to think about, for Aquinas, this beautiful idea, natural law is in us. It's out there in the world, it's the moral order of the world, but it's also in us. it's in our conscience, it's in our appetites. The rightly ordered personality kind of manifests the natural law. For Occam and for Locke, God creates a law which is outside of us. It begins to be, here are the rules, don't break them.
Mm-hmm. Very much,
and
yeah.
It's more externalized, very much so.
Yeah,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and I think that the faith in those periods, it was easier to teach that way. You know, here are the rules, and either go that way or don't. Whereas John Paul II was so wonderful with his theology of the body, explaining, again, almost like in an Aquinas, as Aquinas might, this idea of this integration of body and soul and why we teach this.
Very much so. What happened, all of these developments, beginning with William of Ockham and moving on to people like Descartes, what you see is in Aquinas, the world was still a holistic, integrated place. Body and soul are integrated. The material world is ordered toward the divine, the spiritual, the transcendent realm. Ockham and Descartes and Locke, all these thinkers begin to separate the soul from the body, the idea of law from desire. Another important for Aquinas.
Yeah, yeah.
Law and desire weren't necessarily opposed at all. But for modern thinkers, in fact, natural law is a contradiction in terms. Because natural is what we want to do, sort of our impulses, our desires, and those are bad. And laws comes in from the outside, and it's what restrains us from doing what we want to do. And Locke says that very clearly in some of his more philosophical writings. But for Aquinas and for the natural law tradition, the law is built into us, and we are, if only we tap in properly and rightly direct ourselves in our spiritual lives, we are moved toward proper ends. We follow the law naturally, so there's no contradiction.
Yeah, and let me ask you this as a former atheist. How much of this was inexplicable to you without understanding spiritual combat and spiritual warfare and the idea that man is fallen with concupiscence, that, you know, sometimes what we think will bring us happiness or joy, or that, you know, we pursue the bag of potato chips, but it's not really going to make us happy. How much of that, I mean, how much does, from a modern secularist worldview, can we understand this without understanding that we are fighting spiritual warfare against agents that would like to see us deprived of that complete happiness in heaven forever?
I'm writing a book about right now my own sort of spiritual journey, because I was an atheist. I studied Eastern philosophy and as a student in university, and did meditation and all the rest, and I was looking for the truth, but I began to see, I think began to come to some of the realizations that opened the way to Christianity for me. I began to see that people that I thought I had looked up to intellectually were often very foolish people. Some of my professors believed things that even as a 22-year-old, I could see were dangerous, destructive, and I began to see a lot more good and a lot more bad in people as I got into my 20s and 30s and began to see the world a bit differently. So it wasn't all, I began to grope my way toward original sin in my own pre-Christian way. I began to see that people often just are moved toward doing things that are not only bad, but they're done for the sake of their being bad. I began to see a lot of that in other people and in myself. I began to see that we're often moved. Some of the things that seem to excite us, and again, I think there's a lot of this in modern culture, you know, don't you wish your girlfriend were wrong like me? We've begun to sort of embrace the wrongness of things for the sake of their wrongness. And it struck me, even before I was a Christian, that there was something very wrong about that. And it helped lead me back.
Right. And it's as you say, you're going back now to this age-old question with Aristotle and the separation of mind and body, and you could then say, oh, well, man is inherently bad, and he's always going to do the wrong thing. And so it's wonderful how, you know, knowing that we need to just be aware that we're fallen, yeah, but yet know that we were created in the image and likeness of God for good, and that we have good, and that we just need, yeah, to be able to understand the struggle. You know, yeah, it's not that we have to get rid of everything because, like, in a Manichaean way, the body's bad and the spirit's good. So you right, see how these are just constantly throughout, yeah, history, these struggles to understand.
These dualisms keep reoccurring in history. And again, it's at rare moments when people like Aristotle or, again, Aquinas have these insights that are capable of unifying the world. And then, you know, all creation groans in futility. As soon as we've sort of achieved the synthesis, a generation later, other thinkers come along and begin challenging some of the assumptions of Aquinas' worldview, for example. And now I think we're at a period in history that's, we're really coming close to the nadir. I mean, I don't know what will happen from here, but when I see things that are going on in society and some of the things that would have been shocking even 20 years ago, I see it in my students even. I mean, the attitudes of the educated, quote-unquote, 22-year-old law student are often mind-bogglingly selfish and subjective in ways that, you know, as bad as we were going to school, I think, in the early 80s when I went to university. I mean, I had a student in class, I teach jurisprudence classes, and we talk about the law's ability to shape morality. Does it have a role? Nobody likes that idea. Even the Supreme Court has cast doubt on that idea in the last few years. And I had a student in class about a year ago. We were talking about whether adultery laws are a good thing. Is it good to have laws prohibiting adultery? And the student said, if I want to sleep with another man's wife, I'm going to do it. I don't care what any law says. And I guess it was one of those moments you have. And the fact that he was willing to say it openly in front of the rest of the class indicated to me that he knew what their attitudes were and that they would not censure him for that. And it was a kind of a shocking wake-up moment, for me at least.
Yeah, but that would be the same kid that would say racism is wrong and we need laws to punish, right, people, or that people who won't make a cake for a gay wedding should be sent, mm-hmm, you know, there's a dualism, yeah, there too. I mean, you want the law for things that you support,
yep,
and the morality that you want, but yet you don't want it for things that you don't want. So
absolutely. So that's another, yeah, one of the core contradictions you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. All right, we're speaking with John Lawrence Hill. He's the author of the book After the Natural Law, How the Classical Worldview Supports Our Modern Moral and Political Values. If you have more time, I just have a couple more questions.
Okay.
Of course. Yeah. So I just wanted to ask how science figures into this, because we've been talking about philosophy and theology, and that was always debated in the world largely. There was progression, but this scientific leap that the world took in the times of the Enlightenment. Talk a little bit about how science plays into this.
I believe that, as Thomas Aquinas believed, that there's no contradiction between science and theology. Aquinas always said, there are not two truths, there's one truth. And I think that science, the scientific method, does move us in the direction of knowing more about the world and the mechanisms of the world in various ways. But what has happened in modern thought is that science gets mixed in the scientific method, both of which are good, both of which are incredibly valuable. Science gets mixed up with materialism. Many people, even educated people, tend to think, well, if you sort of believe in science, you can't believe in God, you can't believe in the soul, and you have to embrace, again, this doctrine philosophers call materialism. You know, it's, all there is are physical things. And again, that's an offshoot of Occam and the whole tradition we were talking about earlier. So there's no contradiction, and every great theologian has seen that there's no contradiction. The problem is that science today gets confused with, again, secularism, materialism. one last thought, but the most thoughtful of modern scientists in reflecting on this will say, I understand, if they happen to be an atheist, they'll say, I understand that my atheism doesn't flow from my science. It's a separate sort of presupposition that I make. But in some ways, I make that presupposition before I do my science. It guides my science, that there is no God, there is no order. But it doesn't come from, the godless universe does not come from science, that's for sure.
Mm. And evolution, we have to just quickly evolution. Touch on that.
Yes. Well, Aquinas, again, was wonderfully forward-thinking. First of all, when Aquinas wrote, most people still believed that the Earth was at the center of the universe, and that actually came from Aristotle. And Galileo comes around in the 1600s and says, no, the Earth is at the center of the solar system. Well, Aquinas said very clearly in some of his writings, he goes, there's no proof that the Earth is at the center of all things. We might be wrong about this. I mean, he sort of anticipated Galileo in interesting ways. And as for evolution, well, what more marvelous proof of teleology, of the unfolding of more and more perfection in the world could there be than the unfolding of humanity through the long eons over the course of evolution? I see no contradiction between evolution as we understand it, with the exception, of course, of saying that it's not accidental, as Darwinians would say. It's guided. God has guided the process of evolution, and we are, as human beings today, I mean, we are the fullest development of the evolutionary process, but it's a God-guided process.
Yeah, it's funny because most people do believe in evolution more than they believe in God, and evolution has no original cause. I mean, the original cause of matter has never been solved in evolution.
So exactly.
You talk about having faith in something that there's no answer to. I mean, at least with intelligent design, we have an answer. All right.
Well, a mathematician once said that the odds of us evolving as we are accidentally are equivalent to a whole huge dump truckload full of alphabet soup letters spilling out and forming the dictionary in perfect order from A to Z.
When people, have the Darwin stickers on the back of their car, the descent of man, read the real, what Darwin actually wrote, and I think you'll find in there some ideas that you wouldn't think were forward-thinking or progressive in the world today. All right, one other thing I wanted to mention was the sexual revolution and technology in terms of the fact that we are such a connected world right now that, things that happen in the world, happen on a grand scale where everyone can see, whereas in the older days, you'd have something happen in pockets around the world that couldn't spread as quickly because it was cultural and things didn't change that quickly. Sexual revolution, this is the first time in the history of the world we have more children born out of wedlock and without fathers or mothers. They're born into single family households. The first time in the history of the world that that marriages are it's at an all-time low. As a result of the sexual revolution. And so, while we can look back and say, the pendulum and we're going through a process, that this is really unprecedented in what the history of mankind has ever experienced. So talk a little bit about that and where we're going.
Well, I think it's frightening where we're going. I mean, everybody agrees. Virtually everybody agrees, even, again, the most hard-bitten secularists, that children do best in two-parent homes, a mother and a father, and yet we're going down this path where increasingly, somebody wants to have a child, they do it whether or not they're married, it's done out of wedlock. And I know in the United States, we have, I know among the African American community, 70% of children are born out of wedlock. Among the white community, the European American community, it's crept up from 2% to 33%. And I last looked at the statistic a year or two ago. It's bad news. I mean, it's, and I don't know if you want me to, I mean, I think everybody agrees that it's dangerous, it's bad. And look at our icons, our media icons who trumpet this stuff. And, I mean, the Bruce Jenners, in the gender realm. And it's, I don't know the statistic. I don't know where along that curve we are in a worldwide sense. I know that in the United States, we're creeping up along toward 40% of children last year born out of wedlock.
Well, when we have no morality, and I'll close with this, the idea was that all these philosophies and things came out of a Judeo-Christian heritage, by and large, in Europe. And so the dismantling of that heritage, it's awfully easy to be, you know, thinking God is dead at a point at which everybody around you is at least grounded in the fact that killing is morally wrong, and that I should, if I get someone pregnant, take her and care for her in some manner, or that if I do you wrong, I should make recompense. But when you throw all of that out, and there's no morality, which is where we're kind of going, then might makes right, doesn't it? I mean, if everyone thinks progression is so great, really, if you take God out of the picture, then you're going to ultimately put a person in the picture that's going to dictate to you how you should think and how you should be. And if anyone doesn't think that, look at what's happening in terms of tolerance for Christian thought right now. So you don't think with the group think, there's little room for you. And if morality is taken off the table, then it's whoever is the mightiest person or the mightiest idea, which is the sexual unleashing of whatever you want to do. And that's where all of our law and all of our morality is going to stem from, this idea that morality can do, I can do whatever I want sexually, and that's where the basis of how we're going to think as a culture is. Then you're subject to the whims of whatever the most empowering thought should be.
In one of the scariest parts of that is that it's from the so-called educated elite that some of the most extreme forms of this this worldview are gaining a foothold, and they're influencing. I mean, I see it in my law students who are 22, 23 years old, but again, generally very profoundly unsure of what they believe. And every year we have the discussion about abortion when I teach constitutional law, and it's the one topic where people feel perfectly comfortable with slamming down a book if there's an argument made in a pro-life direction. And the pro-life students, and there's still a significant number of them, they keep their heads low in a law school class. They don't want other people to know. I had a student, one year I actually said, listen, I have about 80 or 90 students in a class, and I'll say, listen, I'm only hearing from one side. There has to be people on the other side here. On the pro-life side, no one spoke up, and inevitably the next day, you know, a student will sort of show up at your office sheepishly and say, sorry. It'll affect our job. Nobody can know what we think about this. We won't get a job.
And you see that with the North Carolina transgender bathroom bill. You know, if Bruce Springsteen
Bruce Springsteen records, by the way. I'm burning all my Bruce Springsteen records.
That's just the thing. I mean, if Bruce Springsteen's against it, then I'm going to be, or for whatever, you know, I'm going to follow Bruce. And the idea is, you know, the thought with that is that at least there should be dialogue. I mean, is it really that we can't disagree civilly and discuss various positions, or do we just end up saying that if you don't think the way I think?
In living in Indiana, as I do, we had the whole RFRA thing whole debate.
Yeah.
And
oh my gosh.
Let me tell you, if people out there don't think that the media is on one side of this in a very deliberate manner, it's time for them to rethink that, because I had some strange experiences where I had reporters contact me, wanted to do an interview about the law, the RFRA law, and I would tell them, this is no different than the federal law President Clinton signed into law 20 years ago, but now because it's religious liberty is seen as in conflict with gay rights, liberals hate it. They loved it back in 1993, and there was a full court press on the part of the media to try to make this law seem different than the federal law. It was incredibly phony, and I was ostracized for taking what I think is a moderate position, which is, by all means, if we're going to pass a an anti-discrimination law statewide for gays and lesbians, carve out the religious exemption for the person who doesn't want to bake the cake. Seemed to me that that was a very middle-of-the-road suggestion, and just for wanting to carve out that exception, I mean, I've had rainbow-colored umbrellas hung in my tree outside my, I mean, there really is, I mean, this is a full-court press. The media is involved in a very direct way, I just think people need to know that there's a lot of manipulation going on.
Wow. No, we are. And I think if there's any consolation going forward, the one thing that I would say is that if we live authentically Catholic Christian lives, then the joy of our lives will be the best witness that we can give to everything that is wrong with the world. That we can't look for a political system. We can't look for a political leader necessarily. It really is to the point of individuals living their faith genuinely that will convert hearts, because you know, the perfect storm with the priest scandal, that, you know, people are inflexibly not willing to listen because we ourselves in the church have put forward a very hypocritical view of who we are. So it really, maybe it's this rising up of the laity living genuinely authentic charitable Christian lives with joy that changes the world.
Very beautifully said. I couldn't agree more.
Well, on that note, we'll go forward with hope, because there's always hope, right? If we don't have hope, we're lost. All right, now listen, I want you to talk a little bit about your new book. When is that coming out? And that sounds like a great... You should be on... Have you been on Marcus Grody's The Journey Home? Or
not yet.
Okay, all right. Well, it sounds like something like that. It would be a great read. When would you anticipate writing that or getting that to press?
You mean the book on my own spiritual?
Yes, yeah.
I'm finishing it this summer, so we will, hopefully it'll be out next year. But it's called Stumbling Toward God.
We've been speaking with John Lawrence Hill. He is professor at Indiana University, Robert McKenney School of Law. And the book, again, is titled After the Natural Law, put out by Ignatius Press. We thank you so much for your time. I know we went over, so appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back right after the station identification. You are listening to Holy Spirit Radio, 1570 AM in Doylestown and 1420 AM in Coatesville and Chester County.
We would understand. You are the rock of salvation, the only foundation.
Good morning. This morning we're speaking with Maureen Ferguson. She's a senior policy advisor with the Catholic Association, here to talk about the recent Supreme Court decision on the Little Sisters of the Poor. Welcome, Maureen.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us this morning. Now, we have heard about this decision coming down. It's kind of confusing for a lot of people that basically the U.S. Supreme Court has kicked back this decision to the local courts. Just tell us briefly about what's going on with this.
Well, it is indeed a little bit confusing, as most things up at the Supreme Court are pretty complex. So what the Supreme Court has done is they've given kind of an initial victory to the Little Sisters of the Poor and the other religious charities that are plaintiffs in the case. I would characterize it as a victory, but not a decisive or final victory. And I would characterize it as a victory because, number one, the court said to the government, to the Obama administration, number one, you can't find these charities while we're working this out, because many people aren't aware, many of your listeners may not be aware, that part of this HHS mandate requiring all health plans to give away free contraceptives and abortion-inducing drugs it imposes fines, very draconian fines, on people who don't comply. So literally, the Little Sisters of the Poor are under threat of millions of dollars of fines annually if they defy this order from the federal government, which they have said they will do. They said, I'm sorry, we can't comply. So number one, the Supreme Court said, you can't fine the Little Sisters of the Poor while we're working this out. So that was a victory. Number two, they sent it back to the lower court and said, you guys have to work this out. So that also is a victory because most of the lower courts had ruled against the Little Sisters of the Poor. So those decisions have been vacated and essentially overturned. And as part of this process, the Supreme Court, in an unusual move because of the Scalia vacancy, because there's only 8 members on the Supreme Court now, they asked for supplemental briefs in this case seeking some sort of a compromise. And as part of those supplemental briefs, the Obama administration admitted that they really can accomplish their goal of giving away free contraceptives and abortifacients without hijacking the Little Sisters plan. And that's all the Little Sisters of the Poor have been asking for all along. They have simply said, we don't want our plan to be used for distribution of these things, which we, you know, which go against our faith. So the government has admitted that they don't need to do this. The Obama administration has exempted 1 in 3 Americans from this mandate. Big corporations like Exxon and Pepsi, Visa, have been exempted from all these Obamacare regulations. But yet the Obama administration is persisting in forcing charitable organizations like the Little Sisters of the Poor to, you know, forcing them to be complicit and not allowing any exemptions for them. So again, I would characterize this as a win, but it's not a decisive win yet because the lower courts are going to have to work this out.
Well, and that therein lies the rub. I mean, I know there's so many different cases at the lower courts. What are the odds that they're all going to come up with something that's going to be agreeable to all the different venues that they're having these discussions?
Well, most analysts seem to think that the court's direction and insistence on a compromise in this case is going to it portends well for the Little Sisters and the other plaintiffs because the government has already admitted that they don't need to use the Little Sisters' health plan to accomplish their goal. And that's kind of the legal test. What is, you know, these legal terms, least restrictive means? Well, they've admitted they have another means to accomplish their goal so that they don't have to hijack these plans. So I can't predict how this will play out in the lower courts because it is very complex. Certainly very complex, and it will probably take a while, so we need to keep them in our prayers for sure, and keep an eye on things. But at least this was an initial victory, and at least these charities are protected from fines. And again, it's not just the Little Sisters of the Poor. They're the lead plaintiffs. They're sort of the, you know, the lead that's been in the media. Yeah. But the Archdiocese of Pittsburgh and all kinds of religious colleges.
Yeah, Priests for Life is with it as well.
Yes, yeah, and some Christian colleges, universities. So this mandate affects all kinds of universities, hospitals, charities.
Right. Oh my goodness. And so, why didn't the Supreme Court just say, no, they don't have to comply? Why did they kick it back to the lower court?
Well, you know, what happens behind closed doors at the Supreme Court is truly a mystery.
Yeah.
A lot of people are speculating that maybe they were split 4-4 on this decision, but I'm not so sure about that because there was a concurring opinion that only 2 of the liberal justices signed. So it's just such an unusual circumstance with the Scalia vacancy, perhaps out of respect for the absence of Justice Scalia.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to seek a compromise and not just rule against the way that they know. I think they all know if Justice Scalia was sitting on that bench that the Little Sisters would have had a clear and decisive victory. I think that's what most people suspect.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, really, it's only speculation, though, why the court did this. And there's really, I mean, if there's one institution in America that doesn't have leaks and people kind of telling all the secrets, it's the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has never leaked a decision ahead of time. And there's very little insight. And frequently it only comes many, many years later that that there's insight into deliberations on these big cases. So if anybody tells you they know why this happened, then they're only speculating.
Well, Maureen, let me ask you one more question. Do you think this will eventually get back to the U.S. Supreme Court if these lower courts all have different ways of rendering this justice?
I don't think so, but I guess anything can happen. But I don't think it's likely. I think the court was trying to clearly say, work out a compromise, and it seems that there's a pretty clear path for compromise because, as I said, the government did admit that they really didn't need to issue this mandate all along because the government has all kinds of ways of giving away, and the government already gives away free contraceptives through the Title X program or Medicaid or all these other programs. So there's simply no reason for the Obama administration to pick a fight with religious organizations and people of faith to force them to participate too. There was no reason for this from the start, and the court seems to recognize that this is an unnecessary fight over religious liberty, and the government, the Obama administration, has admitted that in their court brief.
And if the remedies are different, though, in the lower courts for each of these various plaintiffs, let's say the Priests of Life gets one remedy, the Sisters of the Poor in their district court gets a different remedy, how does that get reconciled in terms of unified law?
Okay, that is a question that I just don't know the answer to. I think nobody knows the answer to that at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're just going to have to wait and see how it plays out.
Okay, and one final question. We have a presidential election obviously coming up in this November cycle. Could this all be overturned by whoever gets elected president?
Certainly. This is not part of the law of Obamacare. This was not written into law by Congress. This is simply an administrative rule made up by the Obama administration. So a new president could rescind this rule on day one if they wanted to and make all of this go away.
Interesting. Wow, that's very interesting. Well, we've been speaking with Maureen Ferguson. She's a senior policy advisor with the Catholic Association and here today to help us sort of understand what happened at the U.S. Supreme Court as regards to the Little Sisters of the Poor, but many other Catholic organizations as well. Maureen, we thank you so much for your time this morning.
Sure. Good to be on with you. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.